Introduce our main speaker for this evening, Tina from Mission Viejo.
Hi, I'm Tina McKee. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Joseph for inviting me tonight. And I want to thank Susie for riding down with me or driving me down. I appreciate it. I feel bad for her because she comes with me all the time. And so she has to hear the same story over and over again. And luckily, I only have one story. So I'm just going to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. Actually, my story is very similar to the first 10-minute speaker, but I didn't come from an alcoholic family. I've never seen either one of my parents drunk. I grew up in a planned community. I had everything, you know, a girl should have to have this nice, normal life, and I just felt different than everybody else. I knew there was something wrong with me. Early on, I didn't know what it was, but I knew something was wrong. And like I said, my parents weren't alcoholic, but I don't really know if a normal family even exists. But you know, my mom stayed home with us, and my dad would go to work every day. And my dad's just kind of a different guy. I'll give you an example. So one time I was playing ball with my friend and her friend. I was about 9 years old, and they stole my ball, and they threw it over a wall where I couldn't get it. And so I went crying home to my mom, who wasn't there. It was my dad, and he didn't like it. He didn't think that they should have ganged up on me. So he thought we should teach him a lesson. And he went out in the backyard and got a 2x4 and handed it to me, and he told me when they came by the house, I was supposed to hit him with this 2x4. And that would teach them not to gang up on me. And, you know, I'm 9, and I know that this is not the solution to this problem. But at that point, I'm more afraid of what my dad would do if I don't do it than I am of doing it. So I do it, and, you know, I wait out front. And they came by the house, and I chased him down the street, hitting him with this 2x4. And a few minutes later, you know, they came back with her dad, and you know, we're best friends, next door neighbors, you know. And her dad said, you know, do you know what your daughter did? And he said, yeah, I told her to. So you know, my dad said we could never play together ever again. And you know, it's like within about 2 weeks, her and I had made up. And I think it took me about 2 years to convince my dad to let me play with her again. So he just kind of has some abnormal solutions to normal everyday problems. So a lot of stuff that went on in my house, my mom would keep from my dad. I started drinking when I was about 12, the summer before junior high, and I went to a high school keg party. And I don't know how much I drank or before I felt the effects produced by alcohol, but when I did, I knew that it was what I'd been looking for. I knew that night, and I loved how it completely changed me, and it completely changed you. So that's what I would do. I would spend my week finding out when the next party was, when I could get something to drink. And you know, at 12, it's not particularly easy. And I really believe the only reason, you know, I started, like, you know, smoking a lot of pot and stuff like that was because it was just easier to get. And I became a daily pot smoker before school, at lunch, after school, at night, you know, and I would drink whenever I could. And I did that, you know, for a while. I don't even know, you know, exactly how long. And you know, for a long time, like, everything was just working great. I was like, this is it. This is the answer. So I would say, in retrospect, when my drinking had changed was I went to Mexico for spring break. I was 15, so I went down there with some friends. And I had never been in a bar before, and I'd never had, like, a real mixed drink before, kind of like the first 10-minute speaker was talking about. I'd had, you know, vodka and orange juice, or at the time it was Tang. Tang was the big thing. You know, I'd had, or Kool-Aid, whatever. You know, we drank all those kind of things. I'd had that kind of a mixed drink, but not a real mixed drink. It was, you know, I'd been drinking a lot of beer and wine coolers at that point. So I don't know where I got it from, but I ordered a Long Island iced tea. And they were great. I was like, I started ordering them two at a time because they were so good, and the cocktail waitress was slow, and I I loved the bars. I mean, I just thought I had found my home. I loved the fact that the rooms were dark and the music was loud and you could just feel the whole room pounding around you. And I'm drinking Long Island iced teas and they're working way faster than, you know, beer and wine coolers. And while I was there, I met a group of people who are older than me, because, you know, I'm 15, and I started hanging out with them, and they were from Orange County, and so we started talking and hanging out, and I loved it. I loved it. And when I got home, my mom didn't know I was in Mexico, because, you know, who lets their 15-year-old daughter go to Mexico? Not my mom. And so right away I got busted because she thought I was in Palm Springs with all the other nice girls. And that year Palm Springs had these riots and they were a big deal. They're all over the news. Everybody knew about them except for me because I'm in Mexico. And so she starts asking me about it and telling me how worried, and I didn't know. And she grounded me and so, I knew I should be grounded. I mean, I left the country. She found some stuff in my bags that I shouldn't have been having. You know, all sorts of list of things that I'd done. And the reason I say that this is kind of when I first realized that my drinking changed was she grounded me, and I was supposed to leave your room. And I'm in there, and I'm completely sober. And I can't stay in my room because I have to have something to drink or something, take something to shut my head off so I don't have to just be with me. And so I left. And I didn't care about the consequences. Little by little by little, I just stopped caring about things. And I took off and I started hanging out with that group of people I'd met in Mexico, and they were all older, so they're going to bars every day. So one of them sold me a birth certificate that we typed up and that said I was 21. So I went down to the DMV and I got a driver's license that said I was 21. And now I became a daily drinker because I could. And I started going to the bars with them every day. And sometimes I'd go to school, sometimes I wouldn't. Sometimes I'd come home at night, sometimes I wouldn't. And my mom would just cry and say, "Can't you just call me and let me know where you are?" I have daughters now, and I just can't even imagine. I mean, I track them on Find My Phone, and they're not even doing anything. You know what I mean? So I can't even imagine how my mom felt. And really, my mom got physically ill from my alcoholism because she would say, you know, just let me know where you are. Just let me know you're okay. And sometimes I would, and sometimes I wouldn't. And sometimes I'd come home, and sometimes I wouldn't. And sometimes it'd be the call from the cops she'd get, or the hospital, or just me drunk and crying, and she didn't know where I was. And I just thought she just needed to relax. You know, I just thought I'm fine. I really believed I was fine. I believed I was invincible. So anyway, I moved out of my parents' house, just into a big party house where, you know, just a bunch of people lived. And I had this boyfriend, and we'd come 2 a.m, and we'd go, at the time it was a Lucky's, and Lucky's plain wrap or whatever is their key buy. So we'd drink the Lucky's key buy tequila. You get that and a lemon for $5. And we'd drink that and wander around on the boardwalk until I blacked out or passed out, and I'd come to and do the same thing over again. And, you know, crazy things are starting to happen. I got into 2 car accidents in a month and a half on the same street, just going different directions. The second one, it was a hit and run. I tried to run, but, you know, I'd already drank that. He and I drank that tequila, and I wasn't going very fast, and it was bumper to bumper traffic. I mean, it was the middle of summer, coming from the beach, and I didn't get very far, and I pulled over finally, and just gave him my information, and he didn't call the cops. I don't know why. He just took down my information and let me go. And that's kind of my story. The boyfriend I was living with, he'd go to jail all the time. Drunk in public, drunk in walking, drunk in riding a bicycle. I mean, it didn't matter. I could be on the handlebars of the bike, you know, that he's riding, and he'd go to jail and they'd let me go. And Later on, he had, you know, he got sentenced to AA meetings by the courts, and he would come home from come back to the house we were living in, you know, with his court card, and he'd say, "You know, you're an alcoholic." I'd be like, "Me? You're the one always going to jail and having to go to AA. I'm not an alcoholic." And I didn't really know anything about AA except for he had to go there as punishment, you know, for these things. And he says, "Well, AA has these three questions, and if you answer all three of these questions yes, then you're an alcoholic." And now I know we have a pamphlet called The 20 Questions, and if you answer three, you may be an alcoholic. But I didn't know anything about it at the time. So he picks three of the questions that he already knows the answers to and asks me those questions. And I'm like, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not the one going to jail. I just thought that, you know, maybe if I ever get that bad. And I didn't know how many minutes that was. he was just kind of the guy. He would do stuff like he would have all his stuff in like a black trash bag and hide it in the bushes or whatever. But he'd be in a blackout or we'd be in a blackout. And then we'd go back later to get his bag and we couldn't remember what bush it was in. So we'd be searching all these bushes for his black bag. And I would keep all my stuff in the car. I kind of lived in my car. And by choice, because I had a perfectly good home that my mom would have been thrilled for me to live in, but I couldn't do what I wanted to do when I lived there, so I would live in my car half the time or wherever he was. And, you know, and he'd say, "Well, you lose your car." And I'd say, "No, if I can't find my car, I just call and report it stolen, and then they find it for me." I mean, I thought that the two things were completely unrelated, but so anyway, so things were getting kind of crazy with the tequila, and one night we were drinking with some people, and they talked about that, you know, if you're Indian, that you shouldn't drink tequila because it's fire water. And I'm like, you know, an 8th or a 16th Indian on my dad's side. So I thought, oh my God, that's why all this stuff's happening. It's the tequila. I was so relieved to find out that's what it was, because I didn't want it to be drinking being the problem. I thought it's the tequila. And so I switched to vodka, and of course the same things were happening with the vodka, so I thought, well, maybe it's the hard alcohol. So then I switched to wine, and the problem with wine is you have to drink a lot of wine to have the same as the tequila. So I'm like, you know, start off with, I don't know, I think I start off with like Boone's Farm or something, Strawberry Hill, and I'm like three bottles of that. So then I'm like, well, that's ridiculous. I can't fit all that in my purse, because you can fit a fifth of tequila in your purse diagonally fine. And so then I'm buying the gallons, which do not fit in the purse at all, and they're very heavy. And one day I dropped it outside of Lucky's, and it shattered, and I was sobbing over my gallon of wine on the ground. And then I discovered wine in a box, and that's a good deal. You can drop a box of wine, and nothing happens. Nothing. As a matter of fact, inside that box is a bag, and you can just pull it right out and stick it in your purse. So that's what I was doing, so I'm drinking wine, unfortunately for me, the same things are kept happening, and I tried to, you know, control my drinking using a lot of other different stuff. But basically, what happened was, you know, my parents started to become more and more aware of what was going on with me, and they stuck me in a treatment center. And I actually went into a treatment center down here. I went to Harborview Medical Center for 30 days, and to the adolescent unit. I was 17 years old, and like I said, I really didn't think I was an alcoholic. And at the time, you know, it's the 80s, so it's a big treatment center era, and the old timers would say stuff like, "Well, I spilt more on my tie than you drank," and the young kids would say stuff, "Well, maybe if you didn't spill so much, you would have got here sooner," and they'd all laugh about it like it was funny, and I didn't think it was funny. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I'm 17 years old. My great alcoholic dream was to be a little old lady sitting on my front porch with a beer in one hand and a joint in the other. And that's how I wanted to end up. I didn't want to end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I just decided while I was in there, I listened to, you know, all the stuff, and they brought the you know, the panels, the H&I panels in, and took us to some outside meetings, and I just decided that, you know, I just got a little crazy too fast, that, you know, I was drinking in bars every day. I needed to just kind of scale it back and drink like a regular high school kid drinks, and you know, and go back to, you know, going to keg parties and smoking pot, and now it's weed. Sorry, guys, I have teenagers, so it's like they're like, "What pot? It's weed, Mom." I'm like, "Okay, don't even tell me what you know about weed." But anyway, so I just thought that would be the answer, and I really believed it. I really believed that I could, you know, okay, I sobered up for the 30 days, and I could have a do-over, that I'm going to start off again, and I'm going to drink like a regular high school kid, and I'm not going to, you know, drink all the hard stuff, and I'm just going to, you know, everything's going to be okay. I just needed to slow it down, and so I got out of the treatment center, and the first night out, they tried to arrest me for contributing to minors because I was drinking with some friends from high school, and I had the fake ID on me, and then they were minors, and so they put me in the back of the cop car, and you know, I started crying like I always do, and I showed them my sobriety chips, you know, from the hospital, and told them it was a mistake and the whole story, and they let me go, you know, I had a moment in that back seat of where I thought about what I heard in the hospital. You know, the girls said it tonight. They talked about a belly full of booze and a head full of AA doesn't mix, and that it gets worse. It doesn't get better. And I just thought at that point that drinking was the only solution I believed would work for me. And they had poured out all the booze that night, so I went and bought some more, and I just kept going. And I did the keg party thing for a week or two. I don't even know. Not very long. It did not end well. I tried to do a lot of different stuff to control and enjoy my drinking. But my last drunk, it was a wild turkey weekend at Bobby McGee's. It was Thanksgiving weekend, and I drank as much wild turkey and blue stuff as I possibly could, and it was just one of those nights. It wasn't the first time it had happened, but it was one of those nights where, you know, I was drunk, and I was, you know, falling down drunk, and I couldn't get up, but my mind was clear. Like, I knew, I could feel all the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, and I could see the people looking at me the way they were looking at me, and I could feel it. I just couldn't get up. And when I got home that night, I drank as much as I could, trying to shut all that off, and I got home that night, and I was laying in bed. I'd done a bunch of other stuff, so I was a little wide awake. And I was wondering what happened to my life. Like, why couldn't I drink, you know, just like all the other kids in school with me? Why wasn't this, you know, working out for me? And at some point, I just said an alcoholic prayer, and I asked God for help. And I had no idea that was going to be my last drunk. I got up for, I was in continuation school by this time, which is no surprise, because I couldn't really show up for regular high school, and so I'm going to continuation school, and there's a guy in one of my classes, and he had bright orange hair, and really skinny and pale white, kind of had that look like he'd been in a coffin for a while, and he had nose rings and earrings, and I thought he was cute, so I tried to, you know, hit on him, and I asked him, "Hey, didn't I see you at a party a couple of weeks ago?" And he told me no, that he was sober 15 months in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So of course I just tried to change gears and impress him with my 30-day hospital stay. And he was a nice guy, and he told me about a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the next night that happened to be a young people's meeting. It was a big meeting, and I went to the meeting the next night, and I met a lady there who was nice to me, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And I've been sober since December 7th, 1986, and I'm forever grateful that that I got the opportunity to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's given me an incredible life, and that is beyond anything I could have imagined, and it's certainly better than sitting, you know, on a rocking chair with a joint in one hand and a beer in the other. That lady, she was nice to me and asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting with her the next night, and I went. And And I just started going to meetings with her, and little by little by little, my life started to change. I was afraid to talk to people in meetings. You know, I was afraid. I didn't know how to talk to people sober. I wouldn't sit by myself because then I'd know you knew I'm some loser just sitting there by myself. So I would stand in like a little group of people who were talking, but I'd be thinking about me the whole time, you know, like, oh my God, do they know I'm just standing here pretending to be a part of this conversation? And, you know, and people in AA and ICE, they'd be like, so what do you think? And I'd have no idea, you know, what they're talking about because I was so incredibly self-obsessed. And luckily, my sponsor noticed this right away and got me into action. And, you know, she'd have me get there early and help her set up chairs or, you know, put them away. Or at the time, all these meetings were smoking. And like this meeting, one half would be smoking and one half would be non-smoking, like that works. And, And I learned that I could have a conversation with you while we're washing ashtrays because I don't have the pressure of a conversation. I can just wash an ashtray and talk to you. And she'd stuff a bunch of us in a car together, and we'd go to meetings together. And, little by little, I learned how to talk to people. And she would have me go to – I was going to continuation school, and – you know, after school, I'd hang out with other people from continuation school who are smoking pot and stuff. She's like, oh, no. You know, I mean, I just didn't have a clue on how to stay sober, how not to live that same way. And she would tell me, you know, each day, when you get home, you know, when you get out of school, go home and then go get a job. And I was like, a job? She's like, yeah, I want you to get a job and keep it for a year. I'm like, a year? My last job before I got sober, I worked at Ross, Dress for Less. You know, it's like a discount department store, and it wasn't very hard. I worked in the fitting room, so if you came up, I'd say how many, and you'd tell me, and I'd give you a number. I got fired, and I don't even know for what, but I do know I was about 90 days sober, and I ran into this girl that I had worked with at Ross at the mall, and I went up to her and I started talking to her. So it'd probably been 9 months since I'd seen her. I'm not really sure, but because everything's a blur from back then. But she didn't know who I was. I had to tell her who I was, and she couldn't believe it. She thought that when I worked at Ross, I worked for one of the programs for like the developmentally disabled. She told me I would do stuff like, I mean, all these things. She told me that I would come in to work like with one shoe on, or I'd come in, I'd always come in because, you know, you never know where you were, so I'd come in with like leaves and stuff in my hair, and it's the 80s, so I had this really big hair, and then like it'd be all big except for one side, it'd be all flattened down, you know, and then the leaves, and she said that I would, you know, people would say, well, what time do you close? Well, you know, I knew what time we closed, but it depended. Is it a weekday or a weekend? So I'd ask them, what day is it? You know, she said her favorite was when I brought in the picture of that boyfriend, the one that, you know, always got sentenced to meetings and stuff. And it was from the 4th of July, and he had, was on the front part of the metro section of the Orange County Register in a headlock between two cops. And so I pointed to him, and I was like, that's him. And so she couldn't believe it. And so I always try and remember that, her and that story, because I would think, you know, oh, maybe it wasn't that bad. You know, I was 17 or whatever, and I was just a mess. And, you know, and so I did get a job, and then I would go to the sponsor's house, and then we would go to a meeting, and she started taking me through the steps, and she started having me pray in the mornings. And my family didn't really go to church. I would go if I spent the night at somebody's house who went to church when I was younger, but I didn't really have any kind of a concept of God, which I later became grateful for, because I didn't come here with a ton of misconceptions. I didn't really know much. And so I truly got to find a God as I understood him in these rooms with you people. And I love the fact that, you know, our God can be whatever we need him to be today. And that my God can be different than yours. Like, I can't have a parking spot God, because then when I don't have a parking spot to park in, I'm mad. And then I'm mad at God, and it's this whole thing. So I don't, my God doesn't find me parking spots. I have a God that gives me, you know, whatever I need to get through a situation, that he gives, you know, he does for me what I cannot do for myself. And it's been a slow process for me. It wasn't overnight. I would get down on my knees, like she asked me to in the morning, and ask him to keep me sober. And I would get down on my knees at night and thank him for another day of sobriety. And a lot of times I felt like I was just praying to the bedspread. I didn't feel it. I just thought, this is whatever, you know, but I did it anyway because she asked me to do it. And she told me that I could, you know, pray to her God if I wanted. So sometimes I would pray to her God, and, you know, little by little, I started to get a relationship with a power greater than myself. And I love the fact that, you know, it's like he can be whatever I need him to be today, and it could be even different tomorrow. It's so great that, that I get to learn all of these different things from you and take a little bit of your experiences and make it my own. And that's what my whole journey in Alcoholics Anonymous has been, is, I've literally grown up here. And I don't think it's because my parents didn't teach me certain things. I just think I didn't hear them. But, you know, here the heart speaks and the heart listens. And I can hear you guys, because, and I believe you. I've literally grown up here. I started dating someone when I was 17, and I married him when I was 21, and then we got divorced when I was 25, and I was devastated. I thought, oh my God, this shouldn't happen to me. You know, I'm an AA, and I have a sponsor, and I work the steps, and blah, 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 you know, and it doesn't matter. The thing here is, you know, life on life's terms happens whether you're sober or not. The great thing about being in AA when it happens is you have a lot of people to help you through it and to share their experience, strength, and hope on how they got through it. And in my home group, which is the Bellflower Big Book group, there's tons of people who have divorce experience, so that was very handy at the time. I've literally grown up here, and I have a relationship with my parents. My mom was easy. She's always loved me unconditionally. She's in town right now. She moved out of state, but a year and a half ago, she hurt herself, and she had to have a hip replacement, but then she had a blood clot, and so she had to wait 6 months. So I moved her in with me, and to this day, she's always like, thank you so much for taking care of me, because it turned out, you know, she lived with me for like a year and a half. It was just the greatest gift to me, because how do you make up to a person, you know what I mean, that got sick worrying about you? You know, besides, you know, she knows I'm an AA, and she knows I'm safe tonight, but how do you make that up? You can't. And I got to literally take care of my mom when nobody else could take care of her, and be there for her 100% when she was completely dependent on me. And I really feel so grateful for the opportunity to have been able to do that. And I'm very glad she's healthy now, just because it made her feel bad to be so dependent. But my dad, he's still the same guy. My parents got divorced when I was 30. And he moved out into the desert to 29 Palms, like in the middle of 10 acres, so he has no neighbors, like, within 10 acres of him. And I guess when he got out there, he started partying and stuff, I've never seen him drunk before, but I guess he started partying and got a DUI and crashed his car, and then he got in a bar fight. And he told it at my niece's birthday party with my really normal sister-in-law, who's like has her own blog and stuff, and all of her bloggies were there and stuff, and he's telling them about how he got in a bar fight with these two guys and won, you know, so he's all proud, big old black eye, I guess it's been a couple years ago now, he shows up, it's like Memorial Weekend or something, and he has a tooth missing, his front tooth. And I'm like, Dad, where's your tooth? And he's like, oh, it was wiggly a little bit, so I pulled it out with a pair of pliers. I mean, who does that? he has insurance. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even know. But, because I made amends to him the way, you know, my sponsor asked me to, she would tell me every night that I had to go home when I still lived with my parents and ask my dad how his day was. And I'd be like, I really don't care. You know, I hadn't talked to my dad. When I was 15, he told me I was lower than a snake, and as soon as I turned 16, I could get the hell out of his house. And I didn't really talk to him except for when I was in that hospital, because they took away my passes until I would talk to him. But other than that, I hadn't talked to him since then. And so I'm like, I don't care about his day. And she told me, you know, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I was like, oh, my God, I hate that one. And, you know, so I would go home and ask my dad, how's your day, Dad? And he'd say, fine, and I'd run upstairs. And, you know, she started checking up on me, and how's it going with your dad? I said, fine, I did exactly what you said. And she's like, well, you know, you need to have a conversation with him. And I'm like, about what? You know, I had no idea. And so the whole way home, I'm living in Mission Viejo, my home group's Bellflower, Big Book group in Bellflower. And so the whole way home, I'm thinking what to talk to my dad about. And anyway, I come up with, when I get home, I tell him, Dad, I think my car needs an oil change. That's my big, you know, thought. And he was concerned because I'd already blown up the engine once in my car when it was less than a year old. I think it was that Pemex gas from Mexico, but the mechanics seemed to think it was lack of oil, so who knows, really. But so, you know, my dad and I got to start having a relationship little by little, but it was like that started that silly and slow. And, you know, when I moved out of their house when I was a year and a half sober, he told me he loved me and I'd always be this little girl and I'd always have a place to go. And, you know, now he lives out there and, you know, kind of goes crazy from time to time. But I do know this. I know that if he does decide he has a problem with alcohol, with his, you know, DUI and his bar fights and all of that, that he knows that Alcoholics Anonymous works because he saw it work in his daughter's life. And I'm forever grateful for that. And he knows I love him unconditionally. And, you know, I'm married today to my husband. We are in the same home group. And, you know, and he's given me an amazing life. An amazing life that I never thought was even possible. I mean, if you saw the way I live today, you'd never even guess, you know, that I'm an alcoholic. And I am, you know, I have two stepsons from his prior marriage that have always lived with us, and then I have twin girls. And, you know, when I got, he agreed to one more because he'd already had the two boys when we got married, and he's older than I am. And so when the doctor, he's the one who spotted the twins in the ultrasound. He's like, well, what about that second blinky thing? And then they told him it was twins, and he was, like, freaked out. And he didn't speak for 3 days because he didn't want to say anything he'd regret. And, you know, and my girls were born 8 weeks premature. They were only 3 pounds. And, you know, and it was hard. They were in the NICU for a long time, and it was very scary for me. And one of them got sick, and it was the first time that I was, you know, afraid to pray. I was afraid of, you know, what God's will might be for that little girl, and I was afraid of what, you know, it would be for me. I was afraid, and I called my sponsor at the time and told her what was going on, and she had lost a son in sobriety, and, you know, so I was afraid to call her at first, too, and she said a prayer for me on the phone that night, and it was the biggest surrender I ever made because I knew what I was surrendering. When I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous and I surrendered, I had no idea what I was surrendering to or what I was even surrendering. But I knew at that moment. But I knew that that God would give me whatever I needed to get through that situation no matter what happened to that little girl. And they both ended up getting to come out of the hospital, you know, one before the other. And the one that had been sicker and smaller, you know, she had a lot of struggles. They diagnosed her with cerebral palsy when she was a little over a year and a half old. And her delay is like a physical delay. And there's a woman in my home group, and she has a son with cerebral palsy, and she gave me some suggestions. And because of Madison's thing is a physical delay, she was able to get physical therapy. And you'd never even know which one was, you know, had the cerebral palsy if you saw them both now. And she also was the one they told me they thought she might not keep her eyesight, that she was going blind. And I was like, so this is probably like when she's like 3. So, you know, I completely surrendered the whole thing at a year and a half. Gave it all to God. It's all you, God. But then between, like, 1.5 and 3 years old, I took it all back. You know, it's like, I got this, God, you know. And I had to do a surrender again. You know, little by little, you know, I've been able to turn my entire life over to the care of a loving God that I found here, that you guys showed me and gave me. And I'm so grateful for that. You know, they ended up telling me, oh, her sight's evening out. She might be able to get her driver's license. I'm like, I didn't even know that was an option. She wasn't going to be able to get her license. You know, I thought, just she can wear some glasses and she'll be fine. So we go, so they're 15 and a half. So we go to the DMV, and the first one, McKenna, she's fine. She can see, you know, anything. So she goes through the eye test. And Madison, she had told me earlier, well, I can't see if I cover this eye. And I'm like, oh, wait, well, nobody's going to ask you to cover an eye. Only alcoholics ever have to drive like this, you know. I mean, I didn't say that to her, but I'm thinking, you know, everybody else drives with two eyes open. So I'm watching McKenna go do her test, and sure enough, he makes her cover an eye. And I'm like, so I'm watching him. So while he's not paying attention, I tell her, you know, how to cheat on the eye exam. I told her, well, he doesn't look at you when you're looking, so just, you know, I told him just to open her fingers and look through her fingers while she's reading it. So what happens with her permit? She crashes, like, within 2 weeks of having her permit into a school bus. I was like, oh, my God, it's probably because I had her cheat on the eye exam. But, you know, I have a great relationship with my kids because of AA. And, you know, any of you who are parents, you know, especially of younger, well, of any age kids really, but, you know, especially on ones who are completely dependent on you, you know, it's hard. It's hard to do AA, be in the middle of AA, and be a parent. And I have to put Alcoholics Anonymous first because without AA, I can't be a parent. And I certainly can't be the parent I am today. And when they were little, Madison would sit on the porch and cry and say, why do you have to go to another meeting? And her best friend, Caitlin's mom doesn't have to go to meetings. And, you know, so then I would get in the car and cry and call my sponsor and tell her, oh, my God, she's crying. And I would show up anyway. Because of AA, I get the opportunity to be a mom and to be there and to share my experience with them and to give them tools other than a 2x4. Because, you know, on my own, I probably would still think a 2x4 is a good idea, you know. I'm so grateful for the tools I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I can, you know, take out into the rest of the world and practice. You know, and I've learned so much from being able to work with others. I really, the 12th step has been the best for me because it's forced me to do all 12 and to take other women through the steps and to hear myself talk about it. And if I hear them, you know, if I'm saying you need to stay in the moment, then I have to remember, oh, I need to stay in the moment, you know. So I'm so grateful for that. You know, if you're new, I hope you get a sponsor and you get a home group. And you show up no matter what, because it doesn't matter what you think or how you feel. It's what you do in the grace of God that keeps you sober. So thanks for having me.